고민을 거듭하는 것이다.
My name is Liam Bird, and welcome back to another episode of the Punks and Pubs podcast. On this episode, I am joined by a familiar face to me, and he might be a familiar face to you if you are one of the 13 million people who have so far seen his cute little face on YouTube. He is my good friend, Nick Edwards. Some of you may not know who my guest is, but for over 13 million people who have viewed him on YouTube and also the millions of people who watched him live on TV, he is the man who performed Daddy's Little Girl on the talent show Britain's Got Talent, a performance that burst him into a viral sensation. But for me, he's an old mate who I've known for nearly 20 years and even shared a flat with him for a couple of them. In this episode, we are at my local in St. Albans in Hertfordshire. We dive into Nick's life in music from his early days in Luton to the ups and downs of his musical career, and of course that life-changing audition on Britain's Got Talent. So let's crack on with my chat with Nick Edwards.
They say grown men shouldn't cry, but it sure as hell living my life. Like most of the time, I don't need no goodbyes. I thought this love was for living and feeling and loving, just like a river flows south to the north. Grown men can cry if they want.
I'm just checking the levels, so that, like, if you...
Oh, so you can actually press record in here and it actually records in there.
No, why are you obsessed with... This is just my iPad. why are you obsessed with the iPad?
The actual equipment is there all isn't... in there. Okay.
For a man who does stuff in music, you knowledge of
I don't do stuff in music. I just basically turn up, do a bit of singing, and then go home again.
Okay. You ready? You
up
for this?
Get it off, man.
Okay, let's go. I am sitting in a bar in St. Albans at my local, and across from me is a man that I think most of you will know as the guy who was a semi-finalist on the 2022 Britain's Got Talent TV show, performed Daddy's Little Girl, and has been watched over, got my notes here, 13 million times,
13?
Nicholas. 13, and was that wrong? Do you know more or less?
Well, it depends what you're counting, but yeah, it sounds a good number.
13's the number that I got there. Most importantly, I was the best man at your wedding.
Exactly, yeah.
So that's what
the best man, the only man around.
Well, yeah, there was someone else there, but they weren't really that good. So I was the best man.
Yeah, he won't listen to this. He doesn't really follow my journey.
And that's why I was the best man. So, yeah, the voice you hear there is Nicholas Mary Jane Edwards. I can't remember your middle name, so I just made it up as Mary Jane.
It's Sam. You should know. How many
is it
years
actually
is it
Sam? Been?
Yeah, Nicky. Yeah. After Nicky Lauda, the racing driver.
Yeah.
Sam, middle name, don't know why, just Sam. Edwards.
Okay, I didn't know that. So, how are you?
I'm all right. This is a really surreal, weird kind of thing to be doing with you, but also kind of in anticipation of doing it, it's kind of been a bit of a journey listening to old stuff, you know, taking me back to, well, most of the years we've shared together, really. It's been cool.
Are you worried about it?
No, not really. Nah. It'd be good to take the journey.
Yeah, it'd be fun, man. It'd be easy. As you kind of hinted at there, we've known each other for like 20 plus years now.
Wow. That's a long time.
And through those years, we've lived together in several flats in sunny Luton. I was at university and you just kind of rocked up at the door with a motorcycle helmet and just told me you lived there now. I was like, okay, yeah, cool, come in. And over those years, you have been someone who I've had a passionate musical love affair with, I would say, whereabouts we enjoyed music together. And I want to kind of explore that as well and explore how you've got to where you are now, whereabouts you're probably as far removed from punk music as you possibly can. But I think our relationship was definitely around punk and ska and that kind of music. But then also we kind of floated into folk as well with the Frank Turners and Chuck Reagan times and stuff like that. You're looking at me like...
Well, no, as I've grown up, I guess I've evolved. I've always been a big lover of music of all genres in the house, you know, as a kid. Growing up listening to all sorts of stuff. You know, my dad was a big kind of Rat Pack guy and he loved his show music. And my mum was like a Motown girl. And I grew up in kind of the late 90s, the 2000s. And over that time, I've kind of always, I would say at the core of all of this, is just I've just been a big lover of music. So I don't really say no to very many genres. I'm open to everything.
See, now the issue is, though, Nick, is that you've done so many interviews, you've kind of jumped ahead of my questions and tried to answer the questions yourself. This is not how it's going to work, Nicholas. My questions will come in when I ask them. My first question, though, is do you want to tell people about a fun story between me and you?
It depends what story it is.
Any story. Any story. Like, if you've got a story, when you think of me and you living together, what's the thing that you think of? Because I've got one. It has nothing to do with music. It has everything to do with you spending 2 hours in my wardrobe to try and scare me.
Yeah. I think we've had... I mean, above everything, there's a reason why we're still friends, right? Because we've grown up together, and a lot of that has had quite a connection to music. But we spent time together, living together, and I enjoyed hiding in various different cupboards to try and scare you. That was my kind of activity.
It seemed to be something you enjoyed doing, which is weird, like a voyeur, weird voyeur thing.
I do it with the kids now, to be fair.
What, you just hang out in your
just hang
kids.
Out and scare them, and jump out, and you know, this is what life's about, boys.
So I spoke about kind of hitting on your love of punk and ska and indie, new metal-y kind of music. I mean, where did that love come from? You spoke about your dad with the Rat Pack and your mum with Motown. But where did the punk...
I think for me, I've always been quite an individual in my personality. So, and you know me, like you can't tell me something that... I don't want to find out for myself. Mm-hmm. I've had that intuition in me. That is something I want to go and explore the world myself. And I think if you've got that kind of in you, and then you collect that with the fact that I was grew up in the the late 90s, early 2000s, when the mainstream music, if you like, that weren't radio pop and was something slightly different, I connected to really. And I think where the journey really started for me was the fact that me and my friends, one of my friends called Dan live around the corner. We had my mate Rob live around the corner. And we all felt the same. We all felt that we didn't fall into the pop and the popular culture stuff. We wanted to fall into, there was something different for us. And we kind of fell into that style of music. So I think the first kind of real album that got me going was Nimrod. So Green Day was the first big thing for me. And I got into Nimrod before I got into Dookie. But after I was hooked on Nimrod and listening to the lyrics that were on that album, you know, like the first opening track, I think it's like Nice Guys Finish Last. The album from back to back is fantastic. In a way, looking back, maybe it just found me. You know, it found us as a group of friends. We were into skateboarding, that's what we liked. That was the music that the skateboarders and the people we looked up to, you kind of the Rodney Mullins of the world, that they and the Tony Hawks of the world, that was the kind of music they grew up listening to. Or that was the music that they were part of, that was their scene. We started with Nimrod.
So from Nimrod, was it a case of, okay, I want to discover Green Day a lot more? Or was it kind of what a lot of people do, and that's like look at the album, like the label, and go and look at, okay, there's this band, or who are Green Day touring with? Or
not really, no. I suppose the culture was TV. You know, after MTV finished, at the end, you know, going into the early 2000s, it was kind of you Kerrang's really. So Kerrang was like the big poster, was the MTV kind of my era. So we spent a lot of time, if it was on Kerrang, it was, you know, it was the next big thing. But I think with the Green Day stuff, I mean, when you find something new and shiny that's amazing, that you never knew existed, and you're a kid, so influential on the things around you at the age of kind of 14, 15, 16, and all your idols, you know, that we used to look up to. I mean, I wasn't great at skateboarding, doing the tricks and stuff, but I loved being on the board. I'd found a home with music at that point. I started looking back at the Green Day stuff and saying, okay, so what else have they got? Then I got into Dookie, and Dookie was a big thing. But Nimrod has always, for me, had a big place in my heart because it was the first, it was kind of really the start of the journey.
The town that you grew up in was Luton,
yeah.
And it's a town that gets a lot of bad like rep.
Yeah.
It's seen as like a place that you want to escape. As someone who grew up in the town of Luton, I mean, what do you think to the place? Because I'm an outsider and I came to
the
university.
I didn't ever want to escape it. I loved it. Yeah. I loved the culture that was in it. I loved the people that were in it. I never had any... There's no bad night... No bad day, no bad anything that I ever experienced in that town. I'm proud of the culture that's in it, and I'm proud of what it was and what it is. And yeah, I mean, I go back there even now to, you know, from time to time, and you know, get my hair cut. I still use the hairdresser that I've used for many years in Luton. I go there every once in a while, and yeah, I don't know. I think your home is your home, right?
I think for such a small town that's close to London, it had a lot of music coming through it. Growing up, were you going out into London to go watch shows, or were you going to local shows in Luton?
No.
And Harpenden or wherever?
Honestly, if I go real back to when I was maybe kind of 14, 15, there was a guy in our local area called Dave Clemens, and he was maybe 4 or 5 years older than us. He was a really important figure in my life because at that particular time, I was starting to get into... myself as a teenager, finding myself as a teenager and understanding life as a teenager with a slightly different view. He would come out skateboarding with us. He would introduce us to all these different styles of music. I guess if I hadn't hooked up with him at that time, I'd never have gone on to meet these people and do these band things. So he was such an, you know, that was obviously his given role in life, you know, to kind of take us young kids through. We looked up to him. And then we spent a lot of time from the age of 15 just hanging around with them and going to gigs. But, you know, it wasn't London. It was happening in Luton.
Something that I know we both have in common, and this isn't to shit on your own family, is that we both come from troubled families. Difficult times with our families, not always the best relationships. When you were growing up and times weren't great, were you finding music as the escape for you?
Yeah, I mean... My personality now and my personality for a very long time has been largely driven on like emotion and largely driven on connection, right? So for me, all of my friends that I know, we talk about deep stuff all the time. That is my connection with people that I meet. So maybe that's come from the fact that when my parents split up when I was six, so I was, you know, 6 years old. At that point, I'm going into the church choir, and it's almost like it's weird. Maybe it happened around the same time. So my mum decided that she wanted to get a divorce, and she moved out, and she moved maybe half an hour down the road to Milton Keynes. So it's kind of, you know, started her own life. And whilst that wasn't particularly challenging for me at the time, because I was like, oh, okay, so we move on, you know, and we're chameleons and we just get on. It didn't affect me kind of in the moment and didn't think about it too long. But I think if you think about it, at that point, I then took that sudden change to go and do music and go and acquire. And then suddenly when I came to my musical styles as a teenager, rather than go down the traditional kind of pop route or listening to music on the radio, I identified with something that wasn't perfect. So maybe these are all just things that just led me to that particular point.
So some of the things that I remember me and you bonding over were bands such as Incubus, Sublime, were two of the bands that I really remember you absolutely adoring. You proper were into
Incubus. Oh yeah, I wanted to basically be Brandon Boyd if I could. You know, I just wanted to say I loved the way his voice was, and you know, I almost tried to imitate his voice. I was absolutely beside with their sound, and I was really influenced by what they were doing. But for me, it started with the Green Day stuff. I kind of went through, and I think if we're going beyond that, when we were skateboarding, me and Dan were really close friends around the corner. We're still friends to this very day. You know, we'd get hooked on all sorts of stuff. I mean, the Vandals are a big deal for us, you know. Live Fast Diarrhea was like the big kind of album for us. Like, we used to laugh and joke around to that album. And I remember this time when it was Dan's birthday, and I was like, oh, you got to come round, I've got a song to play you. And it was, you know, it's your birthday from Live Fast Diarrhea, basically. And so the Vandals were really, really a mega part of it. And then obviously you fall into Blink and you fall into all of that kind of stuff. And I guess Incubus came a lot later. When I'd finished school, I spent a few kind of years where I went over to Harpenden, because I left my family house when I was 16. I literally picked up my GCSE results, and because of all the stuff that was going on in my house, and so I collected my GCSE results and then got on the train and went to Harpenden and basically moved out at 16.
I mean, where did you get in your GCSEs?
It wasn't too bad, but it weren't great. I mean, I would say I probably got, like, maths have definitely flunked that.
And, yeah.
But, you know, I think English was okay. I mean, there were no A's, but who needed A's?
Right.
I was going to be a punk rock man, you know.
So let's kind of talk about some of the bands you were in then, because the first band that I knew you were in was Rare Breeder at the time.
What a name.
And
I never come up with a name, by the way. That wasn't my name, but...
The story I've got told about this, because I never actually saw you play in the band. My understanding is that you were together for 7 months. You were rehearsing constantly. You had gigs booked. You had an album recorded. And then you went, nah, I'm not doing this.
That's probably pretty accurate. I mean, there is a period of a few years where there were different stages of this band, different kind of... So it started off with 5 members, then one would leave and someone else would come in, and they were a different kind of... they were essentially the same band, but with a slight change in members over a period of time. But I was at college at the time. I forget the name of the college.
The college? What college?
Remember I'd done years ago when I'd done Les Mis, and it was there.
yeah, I don't remember the name of the college.
Yeah, so it's like Bedford something. Anyway, so I'm in college.
Before you about to tell the story with Les Mis, why did you keep reaching up to the sky? So you can't visually see this, and I'm about to tell people, but I went and saw you as a supportive friend. I want to support you.
You loved it.
I fucking didn't. I wanted to support you in your Amdram days. And there was a song in Les Mis. Well, there's loads of songs in Les Mis. And you were like the lead. And you just kept... every move was like you're reaching up to the sky to grab something. And I never understood why.
Okay, fine. Right, so I played Andras, who's basically like the leader of the... Of the
kind
of army, the revolutionary army, yeah.
But what are you... are you reaching for bread? What are you reaching for?
Well, you could, yeah. I mean, you know, whatever they'll give us, you know. No, it was kind of like a kind of power thing.
Was it?
Well, in the lead up to that show, the guy who was, his name's Stuart, and he was like the director of all of that. I mean, it was very important that we done certain things at certain moments, and that was an onerous thing. I mean, if you go and see the show in London, I mean, that's a really big power move that he does.
You
know, I mean, if you're going to do it right, you know.
Well, I mean, you did it. It's clearly stayed in my memory. So
it
lasted a lot.
You remembered it because you loved it.
Exactly. It was a powerful move. You're right. It was a powerful move. Yeah. I remembered it now.
I know. And if you need bread, come to me.
Just reach for that bread. you were talking about Rare Breed.
I'm in college at this particular point. I don't know how it happened, but somebody found out that I sang. It was pretty much, I mean, I don't remember word for word, but it's pretty much like, I'll see you sing. Oh, we're looking for a singer. We've got a band. And they were into, like, I mean, Alan specifically, Incubus was such a big thing.
Well, the band sound like Incubus. Like that.
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
What it's,
there is lots of similarities, and that's because, you know, what inspired us at that particular point in time. And I think that's kind of where I kind of crafted my performance and showmanship.
But I mean,
not vocally, because a lot of it was kind of a bit screamy, a bit shouty, but I didn't care that it weren't perfect. We had a really, really good time doing it.
Here I am, I'm making her dance like I never knew I could, but I feel okay, and you've gone and left me for a third ray generation guy, and I feel obliged to hold my tongue.
You're rehearsing for 7 months, you do one show, and your second show you go, nah, this ain't for me. I mean, what was it? What was this ain't for me?
There was one show that we went to, this is kind of a couple of years down the line. So it was at Esquire's, which was a big
Bedford.
Bedford Esquire's, which was a big kind of venue. So we turn up at the Battle of the Bands, there's probably maybe five bands playing. Most of our stuff is just kind of screaming and kind of, we thought it was cool, but so we turn up and we play. And I remember maybe a week later, this guy done a write-up of what it was. And he basically wrote, oh, and then Rare Breed came on, or whatever the name was at the time. And he's like, and he labelled us like wannabe rock stars. I thought, yes, I've done it.
I'm a wannabe.
And that was it. That was the kind of pinnacle moment for me. I thought, well,
and you're like,
you know, that's,
I'm done.
That's it. I'm not doing it anymore. No, I wanted to do it more. I was like, this is it. This is cool. This is exactly what I want to do. But I always had in my heart that I wanted to do music, and I always felt, until I kind of had kids and decided that, you know, maybe it weren't going to happen for me, and I needed to focus my mind on the kids and all that kind of stuff. I believed up to that very last second that I was going to be a musician, and that's what I was going to do.
Well, we're going to touch on that in a bit, but I want to talk about this mission, which was the band that followed Rare Breeds.
Yeah.
Talk to me about this mission, because this mission were kind of the vibe, Funeral for Friendy, Hell's for Heroes, you were the melodic, and then a guy called Mark who was in a band called
Novocaine, I think, or something
Novocaine,
like that. Novocaine,
yeah.
Novocaine, yeah.
And he was the screamy one. And that's what I remember.
Well, the great thing about Mark is that Mark could sing and scream and still sound good doing it.
Yeah.
And I could just, you know, my thing was just sing as high as I possibly can. you know, so, but...
But that was a band...
Yeah, Mark was great.
That was a band that actually did get a little bit of attraction, like, locally, and you went on, like, some tours and stuff. Like, I can remember you guys opening... Well, I can remember you guys playing at Red Red Reds, which was the a venue in Luton, and Angie Shikari was opening for you guys. And it was like, oh, this is weird, obviously, looking now where Angie Shikari are. But like as a band, you did have a bit of traction and you were moving in the right direction.
And again, this is going back to the scene in Luton, how great... I mean, if you go and speak to the likes of Enter Shikari, I'm sure they would say that this Luton has been a piece of the puzzle in their journey. And anyone who's kind of come through that scene will say Luton has been part of the puzzle. You can't just exclude Luton. So on the grounds of that, Luton is part of that journey, and I was, you know, looking back, it was great to be part of all of that. But this mission was kind of, I mean, first of all, I just want to state that I never come up with any of these names. I never come up with any of the names. This is where Kev's going to be sitting there saying, "No, I think you came up with this mission."
This mission wasn't that bad of a name.
If you can imagine that we came out of, so the Incubus stuff was really big, and the band We Can't Talk About were really big, and we had. that kind of era things where harmonies were such a big thing, like Funeral for a Friend. There's one other band that I'm trying to think of that escapes my mind, but they were, harmonies were such a big thing.
Oh, 100 Reasons?
Not 100 Reasons. There's like an American band. I forget the name, but they done.
So by the way, the band that you can't name, are you talking about Lost Prophets?
We're not allowed to talk about them.
We can't talk about Lost Prophets.
Okay. No. But yeah, I mean, their kind of stature in music can't kind of be ignored, but we can ignore it.
Yeah, we won't touch on Lost
Prophets. For obvious reasons,
right?
But I mean, look, the thing is, right, is that harmonies were such a big thing, yeah. And when we all got together as a group, we were like, okay, so this is the way to go. And with Mark being having the vocal range that he had, and the fact that he could still apply the screamy stuff, and which he does perfectly, you know, even now, I mean, I've seen some videos of him doing it even to this very day. He's doing a covers band, and I've watched some videos, and they just sound exceptional even now. So Mark's always been completely on point in terms of, you know, that genre of music, and we really just wanted to apply the harmonies. So that's where I kind of came in, and we recorded some pretty good stuff, I think, and had a good run.
Just a little bit more, just a little bit harder. Stop, you know that you can't do. Nobody can tell you it's over. Even if I try, just a little bit more, just a little bit harder. I tell you just one more time. Just please don't.
The band, I would arguably say, was probably the most successful band, was Comic Boy. Which was a completely different style turn. This is whereabouts I think you started going away, probably away from the punk, rocky sound and going to the more acoustic-y, folky sound. And Comic Boy was either just yourself or you, and I can't remember the guy's name, if you can
Stephen
remember.
Wiley, yeah.
There you go, Steve. Talk to me about Comic Boy and where you see it now, because We have a conversation about like your former music and stuff like that. And when you went on Britain's Got Talent, I said you should put all your comic book stuff out there, and you were like, no. Why no?
It was just the winds of change, I guess. It was my time to try something different. You know, I'm always in search for that. That is what I'm spending my whole life trying to do: search for that next thing and be that chameleon and not to stand still. That's not what I'm here for. I'm here to keep going. So. You know, my time doing... So the Comic Boy stuff was probably some of the best times I've ever had kind of musically, because it was the MySpace days. It was, you know, and that was such an important thing. And those were the times when your Enter Shikaris were really, really hitting pace.
Well, it gave the power back to the artists. Like, for ages, exactly. It was like, oh, you need to be on a label. And it was the first time, I think, in a long time where people were like, oh, like there's this platform where I can put my music and people will find it like organically.
Yeah.
Which hadn't been explored before. Now it's gone to the extreme whereabouts.
Yeah.
Like you can't even make money from your music anymore because it's been streamed by Spotify.
Well, we didn't make money on MySpace either. So
that's very true.
Yeah. Now it's better than it was then in my mind. But I was kind of 25 to 30 at that point. The whole band stuff and the heavy rock stuff and the harmony band, if you like, didn't work out. And I was kind of thinking, I need to get this on. You know, I was dead set. I'm being a musician. I needed to get back into music. And at that point, I was listening to kind of Get Kate Where Kate Fly was such a big thing for me. Mm. I remember going to the Astoria when the Astoria was around and going to see Sam Duckworth as Get Kate Wake Up Fly on his first album. And the lights go down, he comes out on the stage, you don't really see anything. This little light shines on this guy on the stage, just him and acoustic guitar. And he sings the opening track to his first album, Chronicles of a Bohemian, I forget the name of it. I was listening to Frank Turner, the first album at that time.
Well, a lot of those punk guys were leaving punk and going and doing acoustic guitar stuff. Like you said, Frank, Chuck, Laura Jane Grace was leaving Against Me and picking up the guitar.
But anyway, so fast forward to going to the Astoria and seeing Get Kate Wake Up Fly. The lights go down, everyone knows they're going to come on. He comes on. And the opening track on the record is just him and his guitar. And it had so much of an impact on me. Just a man playing the guitar, because there was probably 2,000 people there, and they were singing every single word of the song at the top of their voice. That was a big influence on me. I came back and just got straight going, and then I hooked up with Stephen, and I said, this is the kind of thing I want to do, the kind of bit poppy, acoustic-based kind of pop stuff. And then we sat on the road and we played together for years and we had some of the best times of my life.
You see, we're friends and we're believers. Yeah, we're lovers in the dark. We've taken trips on the provision now and now pretty drunk. We've left the bar too goddamn early. Seems that life has left me feeling kind of down, but I remember who we were. We were the kids that never grew up. We were the only true believers in our futures, past and present. Nobody could stop us in the end. Somehow we drifted from the people that we always thought we would be. But in our hearts, I still remember how it was.
Do you think it was a case, because obviously there's always been a guy with a guitar playing music, like that since the day of dawn, that's always been a thing. But was it a case that you've seen these people who transitioned from being bands and quite screamy, shouty bands to playing folk music?
Yeah, it is a bit of an eye-opener when you see someone in a big, successful band kind of coming in and just playing with his guitar, and suddenly you can hear what he's actually singing about. You can hear the message, you can really deeply hear the message, because it's just him and his guitar. And I loved that. But what I identified with most is that I was at a point where I really desperately needed to find my place in music and push on.
Yeah.
And without relying on other people, because that clearly didn't work, I needed to, you know, because it just didn't work out.
Yeah.
Me and my trusty guitar weren't going to let me down. And over those years, I built up. So me and Stephen got together, then we got a violin player, Hattie, and then Sam came on, and then we got another Sam, you know, two trumpet players, a violin player, and then me and Stephen. And we wrote together for years, and we had a real good run at it. We went around the whole country. In fact, we jet set across to Jersey as well one time, and all paid to do a gig over there. We had a real good time.
You kind of touched on Frank a little bit there, and I wanted to kind of hit on him again, because Frank Turner for me is someone who, early doors, he was someone who we both kind of went, oh, we really enjoyed this. And it's interesting because I felt like Frank left his band and then played some toilets, like some rough, like he came to Luton and there were like 20 people in that room.
Yeah.
Like you
I sat and had some wine with him and had a chat.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So like how much was it like seeing someone like Frank, like kind of showing you that there is a world out there, but it's rough going?
No, I loved it. I really loved it. I mean, the fact that he was in my hometown playing a gig made me feel like I was closer to it.
Mm.
I was closer to it, and that's probably what connected him to the people. And I think that's the medicine. If you can connect yourself to the people, then you've got the magic. That's exactly what it is. So that's why you hear about songs that are so deep. They connect to people and they become a big success because of what they are, you know. And I think Frank's success was the fact that he, you know, played you know, 300 out of 365 days or more, and there was no town he didn't play, and that's why he did well.
The smile on your face, the style and your grace, there's no one around to catch us now. The evening shows and the places we go, and nobody knows that we're out to capture the night with no big surprises. The familiar faces, the young and the braveness, we're off to the show. And here we go, I'm with you. Darling, I love you.
Thank you. Have a good night. Take care.
Sorry, we had to pause because Nick wanted to be a celebrity. Right, okay. So let's fast forward to 2022. During that time, from you stopped doing music, had four kids because you're a maniac.
Yeah.
And you
said one, let's have one. No, let's have two. This is fun. Let's have three.
And then you just couldn't stop yourself.
Four, yeah.
So yeah, you had your children. You've created a business for yourself. You've done well in what you've created. And then 2021 started. And it seemed to be that a way to stop yourself from going crazy, you seemed to pick up the guitar again in 2021. You're at home.
Yeah.
And you just started, like, you hadn't played music. Like, you had a guitar, but you just didn't do anything. I can remember you just texting me saying, I'm fucking around with a guitar again. And I was like, oh, that's nice. Good for Nick. And then you call me and you go, Liam, the craziest thing has happened to me today. And you said to me, you can't tell anyone because I've signed an NDA. Yeah. So I'm like, why are you telling me? Tell the story.
So look, if we go back a little bit. So I had my first kid at 26, maybe 26, 27. My oldest, Jack, is 13 now. So kind of at 11 was when all this stuff kicked off. And I was focused on being a dad. Like that was actually my happy place. Like I actually thought in my mind growing up that if I didn't have music, then I had nothing. And that was really the driving force up to that point. But then when we had our first kid, Jack, and my life just changed overnight. And so for me, I had a greater reason to have a different journey, you know, a different objective, right? So I spent kind of all that time being a family man and just, you know, changed, my whole life changed. You know, I decided to take a career seriously and, you know, really focus the last 10 years really trying to do what I was meant to do, which is support my family and my kids and create a life for them. So that's what I pretty much did. I remember when the kids, because I always had a guitar in the house, years would go by sometimes when I didn't play it. And I think if you don't play and sing, you do need to train yourself again. And, you know, there's some things that are still there, but it's not the same. It's I occasionally play the guitar, maybe once every 6 months, maybe pick up the guitar and I'll do something. And I remember when we had our youngest daughter, who's now six, I just wanted to sing kind of again. I just wanted to kind of play again. And because I wasn't massively confident singing and playing guitar at the same time, because I hadn't really done it too much, couldn't play a hell of a lot really, because it'd been so long since I'd really done it regularly, I used to just put backing tracks on and just sing backing tracks. And probably over the period of about a year and a half, I just was able to kind of maybe train my voice again. And that's when I really started loving singing again, because what I actually realized is this second coming was kind of a mature head, a maturer voice. And I realized I could sing stuff I couldn't even sing before. My mum grew up on Motown and all that kind of stuff. And I realized I could actually sing the Motown stuff pretty well and loved it. So I'd done that at home, and I used to sing. I've got actually a video on my phone, a few, where I'm in the kitchen in one of our previous houses and I'm singing to a backing track, but looking after my daughter, who would have been kind of maybe 6 months at the time. And I'm just singing to her. And that became a thing for a few years, picked up the guitar, actually started playing, started putting videos out. And on this particular time, I'd put Daddy's Little Girl up, which is just me just kind of sitting in my bedroom, playing, and I put it up on my Facebook. Probably had very few comments on it, just a few friends going, oh, nice to see you singing again, kind of thing. Nothing major. Probably had about 4 or 5 comments on it on my private Facebook. And then you fast forward to a year, my wife was actually contacted by somebody, because what I didn't really know much about social media, to be fair, but I knew, like, if you hashtagged and wrote a word, it would link to something. So I hashtagged Dad Singer. A year later, it was picked up by one of the producers of Britain's Got Talent. You know, I've always been of the view that if you're going to make anything yourself, especially in music, you've got to do it on your own merits. Start at the bottom, be your Frank Turner. And that's why I looked up to people like him, because he'd done it from the bare bones and worked really hard and done it that way. You know, he stole the hearts of everyone by working really hard. And I guess that's something that I've had instilled in me, even in my work ethic, that if you want something, you've got to go and get it yourself. When the show contacted my wife, and they just said, we're looking to introduce a new format where we're going to surprise people. We found your husband singing this song. And would he be interested in, do you think, in coming down? And she thought it was a joke to start off with. But then my wife was contacted by one of the directors in the show, and they set up a few meetings. Next minute, I'm in London.
So you had no idea that your wife was talking to producers?
No idea, no. So my wife said to me at Christmas 21, she said to me, we've got a really big surprise for you this Christmas. And I'm thinking, God, I don't know, she's bought me some socks once or some nice pants or something. What could this special surprise be? She gave me a card. At this point, she'd had a few meetings with her on Zoom or whatever. She gives me this card Christmas Day, and it's not actually a present. And I was sort of a bit disappointed, actually, because it was just a card. I'm thinking, it's Christmas Day, and you got me a card. I was a big fan of Gavin and Stacey. She wrote like a quote from the show. So for the next like week or two, I'm searching Gavin and Stacey live shows, all these things. I'm searching, I'm thinking, that's really weird, because there's not a live show and there's something to do with that. Maybe she was going to take us around to see, I don't know, bits on the film or something. I don't know. Anyway, so I couldn't figure it out, because there was nothing online that gave me any indication that there was some sort of Gavin and Stacey thing going on. Fast forward, we have turned up to the London Palladium an hour before. Kath's sister said, oh, I've got these tickets. She said on the day, I've got these tickets. They're spare tickets. We've got about 2 or 3 hours until we've got to go to where we're going, which was our surprise Gavin and Stacey thing, if you like. Should we go and see the show? Because Kath's sister works in marketing, and it seemed plausible that she'd have these tickets or have some link. She does stuff for McDonald's and all these different things. And this particular year, she said, oh, we've done some marketing for Britain's Got Talent. Just seemed quite, you know, plausible to me. Yeah. So she said, we got these tickets. They're pretty good seats. We'll just, and if we don't like the act, she even said, if we go and watch it and we don't like the acts, we can just leave halfway through, kind of thing. I thought, well, let's watch, we'll go, it'll be fun. So we turn up, and thinking back now, I don't know why I didn't think about it, because it seems a bit too surreal. So there's, you know, maybe 3,000 people queuing up. People would have been queuing up from probably, you know, really early. They'll die hard Britain's Got Talent fans to get in. And we just walk up, easy breezy. Oh, hey, how you doing? We've got these tickets. Oh, okay, go to the front door. And I'm walking past everybody, like, they're going, oh, where are you going? I'm like, oh, I don't know, they said go to the front door, I don't know. So we walk in and we sit down, and we're like 3 rows back from the judges, and I'm sitting next to my sister-in-law saying, these are pretty good seats. She's like, well, yeah, you know, we're doing some good work on this show this year, you know, so we've got these good seats. And then a couple of acts go by. This lady comes up to us and she kind of says, look, you're sitting in the Gogglebox chair, she says. And I'm thinking, okay. I mean, I just thought it was the razzmatazz of the show, kind of thing. She links me up with a mic, basically, like a lapel mic, basically, yeah, that was connected to the chair initially. And I needed to go to the toilet at one point, so she disconnected me. I went to the toilet, I came back, obviously. yeah, my bladder's awful. And then I came back, and then she came up to me probably one act before she knew my mum was going to come on with the girls. And she said, I'm not getting anything from your mic. I was like, okay. You know, and she goes, can I change it for a pack?
Yeah.
So she puts the pack on and all that kind of stuff. And then next minute, my mum and two daughters walk on stage. And And the rest is history, man.
Just for people who haven't seen it, I'm amazed you didn't swear. You go, my mum, what's she doing? And you're like, is she going to dance? Because your mum dance? Like, your mum used to be a former
I thought she was
going to
do
it.
I thought she'd, like, set the girls up to do some sort of dance routine or something. Like, I just thought it was going to be something really bad. And I hadn't actually even considered that it could be me going up there. I just was like a bit like, why is my mum there? And then suddenly I remembered kind of throughout that process, my mum is going, they have been saying, why didn't you apply for Britain's Got Talent? And all these things started coming in my mind. But you've got to remember, a minute, if you like, or even 20 seconds, isn't enough time to think what is going on.
Especially when you're like, that's my fucking mum. And essentially, your mum goes on stage and she says, Nick has always wanted to do something like this. We've been pushing for him to do it, so we want him to come on stage. At any point, did you go, fuck off? No, I'm not doing this. I'm not prepared. This is fucking crazy. I'm not doing this.
Yeah, I've never been so scared in my life. Not really because it was one of the biggest talent shows that you can enter. But
I mean, as you said, like, it's a London Palladium. Like, this is a world famous theatre. Like, this is not going to Red Red Reds in Luton. This is
the Wonka ticket fucking, of talent shows, right?
And it's one of those, and it's one of those theatres whereabouts it's old fashioned Victorian, high as fuck stage. Like, literally, it feels like people are on a wave coming on you if you're on stage.
Yeah. I mean, for me, I achieved like the craziest. Sorry, it's making me a bit emotional. The whole thing was just absolutely crazy. I just kind of felt like I'd kind of got the moment of a lifetime, you know? And I went out there and I just did it. And I was scared shitless. They moved me off. They gave me my guitar. They took me. These two guys came to meet me. They said, you know, we're linked to the show. We just want to make sure you're okay. They took me up to the room. I was almost given 20 minutes to rehearse.
How did Daddy's Little Girl become the song that you decided?
Yeah, so what happened was is obviously the link to the song. When I went backstage, these two guys said, so you're going to go out and sing. And I'm at that point, I'm thinking, what am I singing?
Yeah.
They literally said, we found this video. That's why you're here. We found your video. We contacted your wife. They gave me a 2-minute overview of as to what had happened. And they said, you're going out. And this is the song we want you to sing. We want you to sing Daddy's Little Girl. We've already had it, you know, all cleared. Everything's fine to go. You're going out. This is the song you're going to sing. And then they said to me, play the song now. And at that point, I was like, okay, fine, I'll play it to you. But I couldn't. I mean, it's quite a really straightforward song to play. You know, you don't. It's not kind of complicated melodically, or, you know, it's just a very kind of simple song to play. Couldn't even play it for these two guys. And they must have been thinking, shit, you've got to go out in 10 minutes at the London Palladium and play this song. And I'd played it to the girls so many times, played this song to the girls, and, you know, loved the song. Just really felt a really cool connection. Dad of two kids, girls. It should have been really easy. And it kind of wasn't at that moment, because it's like this ticking time bomb that's waiting to go off. And I just kind of had in my mind, it's not as if I've got 20 years to prepare for something like that. I kind of literally had half an hour. No rehearsals, no anything. And I think that was the beauty of it, because why I'm getting so upset about it is because it was kind of a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity for me.
Yeah.
It weren't meant to happen to me, but it did.
Yeah.
And how it all happened afterwards, in terms of how everyone felt so connected to it, was all because it was done the way it was. You know, it could have been done in a different way, right?
Well, you know, how I knew you were going to be shitting your pants, because obviously you called me afterwards, and you do it and it doesn't go out for months, like, and you didn't even know if you were going to be on.
No, they actually said, I'm not sure if it's going to be on, we'll see, you know, pick of the bunch later.
But it goes on, and how I knew you were shitting your pants was because Ant and Dec are doing their little shtick in front of you, and you're like, yeah, like, you, I know you, And the thing that I love the most about you is how socially awkward you can make other people feel by just being weird. And you weren't doing that with them. You just like focusing what you needed to do. You weren't like, I'm not going to engage in what the fuck you two are, and I'm just going to go on stage. So you go on stage and you perform, and I was so proud of you, and I really was, because you're someone who I know has talent, and I know you're passionate about music, and the fact that you were given this opportunity again and you took it with both hands and you fucking smashed it. And that's not just a friend saying that. That is someone who overnight, once it was broadcast, it went fucking crazy.
Yeah, yeah,
like batshit crazy. So like you're being picked up on national television, local news, international news. Like you're being played constantly on Facebook and YouTube. Like millions of views are watching you. And you get through to the second round. Second round comes.
There is a story in between that, though. They actually told me that I weren't through. Remember I called you? So I got a call from the show after it had all aired. And they basically said, we've decided we're not going to put you through. It was kind of really hard, but really easy.
Yeah.
I felt like I'd reached my mountaintop anyway.
Yeah.
I thought, from what you tried to do as a teenager in terms of your aspirations for becoming a singer and a musician and all of that kind of stuff, and then to get the opportunity to have that kind of success, that's maybe the 10%, and you had that, so just be grateful for that 10%. And I was, so I came around to the idea that I was happy with just being in that 10% that just had that 1 5-minute worth of fame. And you actually got a glimpse of something you maybe never could have had. I was really grateful for that. And then the show called me up after maybe 4 weeks of not thinking I was through. But because the video was going so viral everywhere and it was tagging on to all these different countries, the actual original song reached, I think, the top 2 or 3 in Australia and a few other countries. Mm. It charted, like actually nationally charted. But everyone loved my rendition of it.
Yes, I'll admit I was terrified until the moment I saw your eyes. I became a different man when I held your tiny hands in mine. Yes, the first words I heard you say, yes, I remember them like yesterday. Time is blowing in the breeze and you're growing up right in front of me. Your daddy's little girls, precious little angels, dancing in the living room, drawing on the table, wearing mama's pearls, putting on her makeup. Even though I know these moments, they won't last forever. To me, you'll always be daddy's little girls. And so
I was really grateful for the whole thing, the feedback that I got from everybody, the messages I received from everybody. Some are insane, you know, what people, you know, I've had people who have been in war countries and that are away from their family in awful situations that found the song, a connection to the song and to my performance. And anyway, so 3-4 weeks go by and I suddenly receive a call out of the blue from the show. It's one of the producers and she just pretty much says, we've had a rethink. I just burst into tears again. So yeah, and then that was my kind of going into the live shows.
Well, the live show, you decided to do an original song called Love Is. Now I know the show tried to push you to do another cover. Do
yeah.
you think that, because let's face it, these shows are manipulated in the way that they know who they want to win. and they'll push the people they want to win in the way that they want it. Go on.
I think that everyone's been given a fair crack of the whip, and you know, I don't believe that. But
okay, I mean, you're in it, so if you're telling me that's not the case, then that's not the case. You did decide to do an original song. From the things that you were telling me, didn't happen. So the idea where you're going to have like this full band behind you didn't happen. It was just you on stage. Not a bad thing, but it felt like they didn't put the production behind you. They didn't put the support behind you to push you forward in a theatrical way, which I think on shows like these, you might need to push you forward.
I think if you flip it round, right, I was asked what I wanted to do. I was quite hard in my conviction that I wanted to do an original song, purely because if I'm going to do anything, I went and sang an original song on the biggest show, on, you know, talent show, and that's what I wanted to do.
Yeah.
Was it the right thing to do? Like, maybe not, because I'd been unrehearsed, unpracticed. You know, I pretty much put these songs together in a couple of weeks. I spent maybe 3 or 4 weeks when I knew that I was going to be in the semi-finals putting together some original songs for them to choose. I put the videos and the tracks over to the producers, and then they picked one or two of, you know, of the ones that they felt had some miles. But they were really supportive of me doing an original song. But I think my downfall was really just the fact that it wasn't an original song, so the public didn't know it. And there wasn't a lot of strength in those songs because I hadn't played for too long. So I've spent the last few years having to master that craft again and work on my music. But I don't regret any of that. And well, I was glad to have done an original song.
So you lose the semi-final. What happens? Do you get aftercare? Are you supported? Are they helping you to maximise what you've got? Or is it literally a thanks, Nick, see you later, bye?
Well, it is kind of in a way like that, in the fact that they are moving on to the next part of the show. But you do, there is aftercare if you want it. There's a team of people.
Do you think there's enough regarding mental health and what? Because it's a big drop-off. It is a big drop-off.
I mean, I've been fighting. I mean, from my own perspective, within the space of a couple of weeks or months, let's say, I had the biggest dream thrown at me, and then in maybe 3-4 month period, my biggest dream taken away from me. And but I guess that's left enough strength to take me on to do what I'm doing now.
Mm.
I mean, life's journey is life's journey, you know. I think that the show has been great for me. It was great to get me back on the horse with music. And I'm really grateful for the opportunity. And I don't think there's any negative. There's nothing negative that I can really share with you insofar as the show, other than my own hopes and dreams and aspirations for myself. And I'm super hard on myself.
Yeah, you are. But I would argue that as a massive organisation that they are, that the aftercare is not fantastic. I think they go, here are dreams. You can possibly reach those dreams. You haven't reached those dreams. See you later, guys. Here's a little bit of aftercare, but we're not going to explain to you how the industry works in the sense of people are going to try and use you, people are going to try and manipulate you. It's like any reality show, I think, is in a very abusive relationship. And this is just me talking to you.
I never had anybody say to me, you know, here's your kind of kickstart into what might happen. But I didn't necessarily feel I needed. I mean, most of the demons that I've had from the show are ones I've put on myself to try and you know, achieve that dream. I mean, I'm in the same place emotionally with music than I was when I was a 16-year-old kid. Now, that could be a really good thing. It could be a really bad thing. But you've got to ask yourself why you're doing it. You know, I'm doing it because I enjoy writing music. I enjoy writing music and singing. I mean, I'm singing vocally the best that I've ever done. I think I'm writing better than I've ever written. I'm working with musicians that are better than I've ever played with. And so whilst everything along the journey is crucial to the journey, I'm ultimately happy where I am.
You've been given this second chance now to pursue music. You're in a more probably firm footing financially, whether you can kind of grasp it a bit more than you probably could as a 20-something year old kid. You've released an EP, 1960, is that right?
1960, yeah. I mean, that reached the country charts, that did.
There you go, see? I do take those. How far do you realistically think you can take this?
We're kind of going slightly onto a whole new footing. For me, music has been a journey that doesn't end. I'm kind of still feel I'm somewhat young enough to take some strides towards being, you know, living my dream. And
final question I ask everyone who does a podcast: you can have a beer with one person. Time is not an issue. Money's not an issue. Distance is not an issue. Who are you having a beer with?
So I'm not name dropping here. I'm saying it because I genuinely mean this, but I went over to Nashville last year and I spent some time at Johnny Cash's son's house, and he's always been a massive influence for me as I've got older. I would love to sit in a room and talk to him.
Johnny Cash's
son
or Johnny Cash?
No, Johnny Cash himself. Yeah. I'd love to sit down and talk to him and understand what his journey. I'd love to do what you're doing, but do it with someone like Johnny Cash. That would be incredible for me.
Nick, I love you. Thank you for doing this with me. I know this has been something that I've been pestering you to do for a while, and I can understand how it might be awkward doing it with someone like me. But yeah, you're a fucking good dude, and people should check out your music because it is good. Even though I don't like country music, I will support you and endorse you until the day I die. So, Nicholas, I don't think I've ever told anyone I've loved them at the end of a podcast, but I love you dearly. Thank you, mate.
I love you too. And look, it's been great to reminisce about the old times. And I think we probably could have done another hour, right?
Yeah, but I don't think people want to listen to that.
No, exactly. I appreciate the time, man.
Way back on the line down in 1995, there was a young boy with nothing much on his mind, but with a family, the love, and he can make it a man. He was a troubadour, so with a world full of gold. Since then he's had the devil on his shoulders, since God knows when.
Thank you again to Nick for joining me. If you would like to know more about Nick's music, there are links in the episode description. He's also doing some live shows across the UK, so make sure you check him out if he's in and around you. If you haven't seen his performance on Britain's Got Talent, you can find a link in the episode description as well. I'll be away for a few weeks. I'm flying out to Mexico, so the next episode might be a little delayed, but I will get something out as soon as possible. In the meantime, if you missing my voice, go back and listen to old episodes. There's plenty of episodes there to keep you entertained. Until next time, if you go into a punk show and you see someone fall down, you pick them right back up again. I love you. Bye bye.
Back down the road when I was young, 22. We sing songs about living, friendships, and you. But like the devil went away till he caught me further down the line. I was that troubadour, so with some time on my side. Since then I've had the devil on my shoulders, since God knows when. I've been smoking, drinking. sometime God gets through, or it's the devil's juice. Said I'm a troubadour, so sin like you. He said I am a troubadour, so sin like you. Yes, I am a troubadour, so sin like you.